I can meditate in the morning and then something happens an hour later, poof, there go all of the beautiful, tranquil thoughts I thought that were within my DNA by that time. And then you know what? I get right back on my mat again. I get right back on my cushion and I try again. And then I'd apologize to the person that I would said some unkind words to. And I try to be better every single day. I am Toni Presley Sanon, seeker, mother, artist, nature worshiper, moon lover, and on the path.
Toni Presley Sanon is part of a growing number of Black women drawn to Buddhism. Her journey into the contemplative practice was not a radical departure, but a series of starts and stops, and one that reflects a pattern from her childhood. Welcome back to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan. Toni Presley Sanon is the Associate Professor of American Studies at Eastern Michigan University. Her area of expertise is memoir and history of African-American experiences. And it literally dwells, as she likes to say, at the intersection of history, memoir, and cultural production in both Africa and the African diaspora. In February 2024, her fifth book was published, this time by a Buddhist publishing house, Shambhala Publications. And it is a departure from her earlier writing. Presley Sanon has written extensively about Haiti, a country that she loves and feels deeply connected to. In fact, it's where, she tells me, she discovered a spiritual practice of healing and a connection to the earth that today she might call a meditation. Lifting as They Climb, Black Women Buddhists and Collective Liberation is a deeply personal reflection offering insight into why so many Black women are finding healing in the contemplative traditions of Buddhism. It's a trend that's been making headlines over the last 10 years. There are a growing number of sanghas now. Those are communities of practice that are specifically organized for those who identify as people of color, Black, or of African descent. Toni joined me by phone from her home in Eastern Michigan to talk about the book and to answer that big question. Why are so many Black women finding healing and liberation in Buddhist practice? Toni, welcome to the program. I'm excited to talk to you about so many things, but first, let's start with the book. Describe what makes it unique.
My religious tradition was multifaceted. My mom was never one of those people who necessarily forced us to go to church, but she was a seeker. And so we were Baptist for a while, Pentecostal for a while. I think at one point we were Seventh-day Adventist. And so I grew up going to church quite sporadically, but as part of a Black community, right, where church is so central to the community, it was always in the environment. I actually still have my mom's Bible. Even though I don't label myself a Christian, I understand the sacredness of the book in her life. And so I hold it very, very dear.
You were not always in this place, seeing and feeling a clarity in your own self about your path forward and about what you describe in your opening pages of your book as feeling a profound sense of loneliness, being adrift, struggling and coping with anxiety. It is such a vulnerably open and radically candid image of yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The book is called Lifting as They Climb, Black Women, Buddhists, and Collective Liberation. And it's the profile of six Black Buddhist women. There's Jan Willis, Bell Hooks, Zenju Earthlin Manuel, Angel Kyoto Williams, Spring Washam, and Faith Adiele. So as I was writing this book, I reminded myself over and over and over again that this is not about me. This is about this very important work that these women are doing as part of a long literary tradition and sharing their own narratives. This book is different from anything I have ever written. This is not something that normally we do as academics, expose ourselves. We are the neutral researcher who becomes the expert on the subject. And I understood after reading the work of these women that that was no longer acceptable. These women are talking about how we get free, how we not only liberate ourselves from our oppression, but how we can all be liberated through mindfulness, through community, through the teachings of the Buddha. And so I understood that if I tried to approach this subject in a way that reinforced a Eurocentric, individualistic way of being in the world, then I was doing a disservice not only to these women's work, but also to the work of our ancestors, who were quite vulnerable in their own writings. If we think about the writings of Harriet Jacobs or Frederick Douglass or Sojourner Truth, the speeches that she made in which, you know, she's baring her chest and saying, "Ain't I a woman?" This is incredibly vulnerable. And so it just seemed the least that I could do to talk about my own struggles as a Black woman in this country, in academia, where there are so few of us, and with so many of us dying on the vine.
You write that you were struggling at a time when your only child was leaving home. You were at an age and a point in your career where you were facing decisions and transitions, and you were wondering and grappling with the direction that you needed to be taking, and you could feel fear and anxiety creeping in. I got the distinct impression as I read those opening pages that you were kind of white knuckling your way through each day. You know, that line that you share, a pot of coffee to stay awake and wine to help you fall asleep downstairs on the couch, and the sense of loneliness that you open up and share, that's an experience a lot of people are having right now. And here you are, this Black woman with a doctorate, holding a position in the academy, commanding the lectern in classrooms and charged with teaching, you were finding yourself on the couch where folks couldn't see you.
We cannot continue to hide behind the pages of our intellectual prowess while we are suffering in our daily lives.
What led you to decide that the coffee and the wine were not working? What led you to meditation?
I came to this path via a very simple app on my phone. And thank goodness that that app existed, because I don't know where I would be otherwise without hitting that play button first time and sitting for 30 seconds. I might have never discovered week-long retreats where I get to be with myself and to contemplate the gift of this body that I have. I knew that I could not continue on the path I was going on because I was dishonoring this gift of a body that I'd been given. I knew that I couldn't serve my students to the best of my ability under those conditions. I knew that I couldn't do the work that I was put here to do, and I needed to shut it all down. I needed to move towards something that was going to be a source of life rather than a source of death, which is what that lifestyle was at the time. That sense of isolation, that drinking of so much coffee with sugar, by the way. I also had an addiction to gumballs, right? So I was looking for sweetness in my life.
Which is something many people do. There is a desire to ameliorate. And for some, the amelioration can come in the form of certain foods and substances that start to create their own cycles of demand.
Yes, this is true.
You find yourself stuck and you are not happy with where you are, and you decide to reach for that mindful app. Why the mindful app and not a game to deconstruct, you know, word puzzles to relieve stress? Why the mindful app? Why were you drawn to meditation, do you think?
Yeah, I love that question. Working at LaGuardia Community College in a summer program, and in between all of the planning of classes, I remember someone looking over at me and saying, "Do you meditate?" And I had no idea what meditation was. I would just be sitting there perfectly okay with doing nothing, with not distracting myself with something else. And at the time, I may have just kind of nodded my head.
You didn't have a name for that
I had
practice.
no name for it. I just knew that it felt really good to just be.
I want to keep that radical candor going here.
It's not a linear path.
It's not a linear path, Tony, but listening to your story, there is a rhythm and a pattern here of you discover and then you seem to not forget, but let go of the rituals, and you retreat back to the habits of looking for maybe comfort. I don't know, relief. I don't know.
It's a complicated thing. It's part of the human condition too, I think, to be awake and to fall asleep, right? It's
I love that you just said
can be
that.
hard to be awake.
You are honest about that in the book again. About the struggles. So, for somebody who's listening to the calm tranquility of your voice and this awareness that you are on this journey of trying to really spread the word about this liberatory experience and these lessons embodied in the autobiographical stories of these six Black Buddhist women, you also want to be real about it.
We have to be real about it. There's a Buddhist expression, ehi pasiko, right? See for yourself. And I think that was one of the driving forces of the book as well. It's basically, if I can do this, you can do this. See yourself in my story. My story is interwoven throughout the stories of these narratives. I was a girl from Queens who somehow ended up in the Midwest, in Michigan. And we are all connected. We all have the capacity to wake up, right? And yes, we will fall asleep. Again, I can meditate in the morning and then something happens an hour later, poof. And then I apologize to the person that I said some unkind words to. And I try to be better every single day. And I try to, at the same time, look at these systems that make me want to lash out at someone else, that make me want to separate myself from someone else's suffering, that make me want to retreat into my solitude and to not see my suffering as part of a larger human suffering. There are so many wars going on right now. People are suffering every single day, and we have to feel compassion for those people, even though they are not right in front of us, right? We can feel them. We can know their suffering as part of our own suffering because we are all human, because we all share this human condition.
There are a growing number of critics now who are saying that all this focus on self-care is actually destructive to society and that it is kind of birthing an industry with false promises that are in some ways intended to replace religion. What do you say to those critics of the movement of self-care?
I think that one of the starting questions we need to ask is why this need to belittle people's vulnerability? Why the need to belittle people's push or desire to actually bring to light something that we all grapple with as human beings? As the Buddha said, we are of the nature to suffer in these human bodies. And so it seems to me that this desire to belittle something that is intrinsic to our human condition is akin to all kinds of ways that we have grappled with the history of this country, where to speak about the foundational nature of white supremacy in this country is somehow woke culture. It is a denial of our humanity, which just keeps us in the same position that we started out in, which is one in which the status quo remains very much in place. So when you ask these kinds of questions, for me, it's stepping back, asking why these kinds of efforts at discrediting a truth get so much attention. There is so much work that is being done by people who really want to help us wake up, not only for ourselves individually, but for our world, not as separate from each other. Yes, these are Black women, and yes, they are speaking to Black women's conditions, but they are also thinking about our collective liberation. And I think these kinds of things can be very threatening to the status quo. If we are not able to see each other as the enemy, as the other, then we're not able to shoot people down. We're not able to belittle other people's suffering. And I use that word other in quotes because there is no other.
Sounds almost like you're saying when you see the humanity in another person, it awakens a sense of responsibility.
Right. A sacred communion, not only with each other as human beings, but also with the earth.
I'm talking with Toni Presley Sinnall. She's the author of a new book, Lifting as They Climb, Black Women, Buddhists, and Collective Liberation. For nearly a decade now, there have been a growing number of stories documenting the rise of Black women, finding healing and what many describe as freedom in the contemplative traditions and wisdoms of Buddhism. In her new book, Presley Sinnall explores those experiences and stories through the autobiographies of six Black Buddhists. Let's get back to the conversation.
For a long time, there was a saying that 99% of Haitian people are Catholic and 100% are vaudouisant or servitor, which means that they serve the spirit or loi. Back in the 90s, it was a very different place from what it is now. I lived there for about 2 years. I got to see a different way of interacting with the natural world than I ever saw in the United States. Vodou is a nature religion. At its core, it means spirit. And so there's a very deep understanding that everything has spirit, right? When I was there, there were still many sacred forests, sacred trees that could not be disturbed, not only because they were ecologically important, right? For example, there's a mapu tree that will tell you where there's a source of water, but also because there was the belief that spirits lived in those trees. Even though these are seemingly inanimate objects, there was a very basic understanding that all beings hold life, no matter whether we see them moving or breathing. And not only did I come away from Haiti with a meditation practice, even though I didn't know it was a meditation practice, but I came away with a very deep appreciation for natural resources and for our inextricable connection to the earth. And that's something I've carried with me since. When I was writing the book, I saw many connections between concepts like interconnectedness or interbeing and Ubuntu, I am because we are, right? So that we are not separate from one another.
There's been a lot of writing about the rise in the number of Black women making their way into Buddhism. What do you think's going on there?
Our pull towards Buddhism is part of a long tradition of African-American people gathering our resources in whatever form they come in order to liberate ourselves. So under slavery, we had Christianity imposed upon us. And we can see throughout history, throughout that period of time, there were enslaved people who used the Bible as a means of inspiring their revolutionary practices. So we take what may seem foreign to us and adopt and transform it so that it can be deployed as a tool of liberation. And I'm a little bit loath to say this word tool, because I don't want it to seem utilitarian.
It's interesting that you say that, because in our Western culture right now, meditation and mindfulness have been marketed as tools, as modalities for confronting pathologies that we may be feeling or experiencing in modern life. And it's often devoid from the wisdom traditions that gave birth to the practice.
Yeah, it depends on where you're looking, right? So we do have what's sometimes called mindfulness, but I do think it has its place, right? So we have teachers who advocate for mindfulness to be better workers, right? To be better partners, to be better parents. And I think that that has its place. There are more devotional paths around mindfulness, around meditation, and those are very important.
It sounds like you reject a purist attempt to put up fences around practices like meditation. It sounds like you are not a fan of insisting that the only path for meditation must be rooted in the following precepts or the following beliefs, that you can be a non-religious, not identified as Buddhist person and still engage in meditation as you did in your own journey.
Exactly. And however you come to it, however you come to being a human being who is more humane, then more power to you, right? I think that these kinds of arguments that go on between people who have a more devotional path and who, you know, may be part of a corporation and this is one of the trainings that they do, I think it perpetuates the separation that got us into this situation that we're in.
You're not condemning a secularized introduction of mindfulness into our lives, because sometimes that becomes the first step of discovery, and you'd prefer that to be accessible to more people or available than not.
Definitely. Again, it's how I came to it, to this path.
Sure.
I think whatever path you take to get where you need to go,
yeah,
that path is perfectly okay. And it's one of the reasons actually that I wrote this book, as an opening to some of these women who had childhood, who had lives that we will be familiar with and who have also come to this path. So again, as I said earlier, if I can do it, anyone can do it. Hopefully I am an example of what's possible when we do devote ourselves to a path of liberation, not just individual liberation, but collective liberation. If I were to offer any kind of criticism about the way that Buddhism or mindfulness has come to the West, it's the emphasis on individuality.
Mm-hmm.
Because in many Buddhist traditions, it's the collective that is considered, you know, the individual is always interrelated with the collective.
Yeah.
Which is also very familiar to an African-American person who, you know, growing up in the Black church, it's about our collective suffering and it's also about our collective joy within the church. Sangha itself means beloved community. It's a Sanskrit word. If we know of the teachings of Martin Luther King, that's exactly what he was talking about when he talks about the beloved community. So many of the concepts that we find, or the principles that we find in Buddhism, are not so foreign to African American people.
Mm. You wrote that you decided to look intentionally for other people of color exploring Buddhist practices and rituals. Can you talk about that decision?
When I started my meditation practice, I did it in isolation. I bought a Zafu cushion from Amazon and set up a little place in my home and thought that was okay. for a while, just to sit and meditate on my own and to read. That's how I enter into whatever it is that I am immersing myself in, is through books. But then that wasn't enough. It seemed to me that it was much easier to return to my old patterns when I was practicing alone. I had no accountability. I had nobody that I knew who was also on the path. I couldn't see myself reflected. And so over time, I reached out to there where I live. There are several temples, and I've been to a couple of temples here, but it continued to be an isolating experience for me, in part because I didn't see myself reflected. I didn't hear the kinds of conversations happening that I felt that I would find nourishing, that would give me access to the Buddha's teachings. And so I left those temples and, again, you know, went back to sitting by myself. But I believe that if you stay on this path, that what you need will come to you. I've been really, really blessed to now be part of a home sangha and still breathing. Osho Zenju is my teacher. I have been part of other beautiful sanghas, one led by this beautiful teacher, Margarita Loynez, from the Dominican Republic. I regularly attend Spirit Rocks BIPOC Sangha, which has guest teachers. There's IMS's Sangha, which has BIPOC sits. And what happens in these is that there is a sense that the Buddhist teachings are made accessible through these bodies that have had similar experiences in this country. Even if these stories aren't directly related to our own experience, there is a kind of truth behind those stories that we can immediately connect to, which again makes the Buddha's teachings all that more accessible.
What I'm hearing you say is that it was essential for you to be in spaces where there were other Black Buddhists practicing.
Definitely. Yeah. There's definitely that need. There remains that need.
Is that who your book is for? Or is it for everyone?
The book is for everyone. One of the teachings that I've taken from Black women, from the Combahee River Collective, in the 1970s, they were talking about the fact that if Black women are free, then that means all of us are free, because we are some of the most oppressed people in the world. And I really believe that to be true. I think that what these women who are the focus of this book uphold is this foundational understanding that in advocating for our own liberation, we are advocating for the liberation of all beings. We understand what oppression is. And so we are talking to each other, and we are talking to everyone who wants to get free. Unless everyone is free, then none of us is free, again, which is something that has been part of the African American tradition for centuries.
Yeah. This book is not only a departure for you from academic writing. The way you write about these six Black Buddhist women is not typical. In fact, it's quite different in that you reached out to them as you were writing. Can you talk about why you chose that approach?
One of the organizing factors in the book is that they wrote memoirs. And if they didn't write memoirs, they have writings that are highly autobiographical. And so I could pull out aspects of their lives that speak to some of these larger teachings. The way that the book is written is, I believe, as important as what is written in it. So unlike other books that I've written, which were totally solitary for the most part, this was actually done in community. It is memoir, but it's also how you write about memoir that's important. Most of these women were still alive. So why was I writing about them without consulting with them, without making sure that they were being represented or spoken about in a way that they wanted to be spoken about? Why wasn't I sharing what I was writing about them with them so that they could have a voice in how they were portrayed to the world? And so I, with my heart in my throat, emailed each one of the women, and not everyone got back to me, but those who got back to me, I sent them their chapters and they responded and commented on it. And we went from there. It was really a very beautiful process, and I think changed me as a writer forever. It no longer becomes an intellectual activity, right? This book writing, it becomes something that's embodied. And so I see myself as part of this legacy of writing ourselves into history. And I can't do that alone, right? Again, the Sangha is very, very important. And so if we try to continue with a system that privileges the individual voice at the expense of other voices, one history with a capital H at the expense of these multitude of histories, then we will end up in the same situation that we find ourselves in today.
Toni Presley-Sennell is the Associate Professor of American Studies at Eastern Michigan University. She is the author of 5 books, including her most recent title, Lifting as They Climb, Black Woman Buddhists and Collective Liberation, published by Shambhala Publications in February 2024. You can find links to her book on this week's show notes at interfaithradio.org. You can also stream or download the entirety of this conversation. That's all for this week's show. If you missed any part, you can stream it online at interfaithradio.org. While you're there, you can also learn about us, read the show notes, sign up for our newsletter, and explore the archives. You can find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or really the podcaster of your choice. Just search Interfaith Voices. And while you're there, help us out. Leave a rating and a review. It helps others find us. Music by Blue Dot Sessions, and a special thanks to our founder, Maureen Fiedler. This week's episode was produced by Kevin McCarthy and Kimberly Winston. Inspired is a production of Interfaith Voices. We're a nonprofit, and we rely on the generous support of our listeners to bring you this show. I'm your host and executive producer, Umbreen Khan. Remember to stay safe, stay well, and stay connected. I'll see you next week.